Okay, last time. This is drugs. This is your brain on drugs. Any questions?
Yeah, we have a few. New studies show that pot changes the structure of young brains. We're going to find out about the latest research into that. But first, the Obama administration released new rules today in an effort to rein in runaway student debt. They're called gainful employment rules, and the idea is to crack down on colleges that make a lot of money through federal student loans but do not do much to train students for the workforce. The rules will hit the for-profit college industry the hardest. Critics say the new regulations don't go far enough. Anthony Carnevale is director of the Center on Education and the Workforce at Georgetown University. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you. All right, so how are these new gainful employment rules supposed to work?
It's going to make it a little harder for people to sell job training for jobs that don't exist, essentially. It's a prohibition against telling people that you're going to give them an education, a certificate, a degree that will get them a particular job. And when the job doesn't come, or you don't get a job at all, or you don't earn enough money to pay for the education you got, then the federal government's going to step in and say, at least you can't use our money. We won't allow our students to use federal money to pay for that program.
Well, why are the schools being made responsible for the student being able to get a job?
Because they're selling the Brooklyn Bridge. It only just comes with a few books and some classes. That is, it's consumer fraud. They're basically telling people that the programs that they're offering will get them a job. For instance, in one case, they claimed that selling job training in a prison that I know of, that they'll get you a job and you'll be a police officer, but didn't bother to tell the prisoners that felons can't be police officers. So it's that kind of fraud. It's the sort of thing that's fairly obvious. It's not subtle. No one's going to stop you from taking a course in Shakespeare here. That's not what it's about.
Right, right. So it's not saying, oh, sorry that you got that anthropology degree and you can't get a job. It's not that kind of thing. And this is going to hit the for-profit college industry the hardest. Why is that?
For-profit college industry is not all bad. That's what's sad about this in many ways, because this harms their reputation because of a few bad apples. And they've grown enormously since the 90s, and largely because the demand for post-secondary education has grown enormously, and there is a third-party payer, which is the federal government. So if you can get some, you can set up a school and get people to come, you can get money from the federal government if you fill out the forms for the students and they give the money to you. So we created something of a problem here because we didn't have enough capacity in our regular higher education system. So all sorts of new institutions have sprung up, and we're only just now learning to get control of them.
Yeah, so as you say, these colleges attract people who can't get into other colleges, maybe community colleges, and yet these new rules might put, as far as the administration says, 1,400 schools out of business.
In the end, the rules won't put schools out of business. They'll put programs out of business, and that's an important distinction. That is, you can go to a particular school and be in a program, say in criminal justice in the case I just mentioned, and in the end, the job they promise you at the end of the program is not there for you. And that's consumer fraud. So the school doesn't necessarily go down. It's the program that matters. But in many cases, we're talking about schools that have many programs that don't work. And so in those cases, the schools themselves ultimately fall. But in most cases, it's a program in the school that fails.
So I understand that this program, the loans cannot be more than 8% of the income that you make when you graduate. And is that a big problem, that students who go to these colleges are just swamped in debt that they can never repay?
It is increasingly a problem, especially in this sector. That is, if you're a student, they fill out the paper, you sign it, you get the loan money, you give it to them. You don't make it through the program, or you do and you get a job and you don't make enough money to pay back the loan, you default. You'll never get another student loan from the federal government, so you're one and done. You're not going back to school. Even now, the federal government is going to give these schools 5, 6, 7 years to straighten out. So the students, the schools get lots of chances. The students get one, and then they're done. So this is not a radical set of penalties. It's actually quite, most people would think it's way too soft. I think it's a reasonable compromise, frankly.
Right. The critics are saying that this doesn't help students that drop out, and most of the students at these for-profit colleges do, in fact, drop out.
They drop out largely because, in many cases, they're unable to do the work, in many cases because they do not see and find out from their fellow students too late that there's no job at the end of this pipeline. And so they wander away, but the debt follows them. And that's the more serious problem, apart from the money they put up front. And the other thing is that these programs tend to be more expensive. What you can get for $7,000 or $8,000 at a community college, you'll pay $30,000 or $20,000 per annum at a for-profit school oftentimes. So they're very expensive, and the debt's very high in many of these programs.
So if this is such a problem, and these are federal student loans, why doesn't the federal government then try to forgive some of this debt or lower their debt payments?
That's a good question. There is a difficulty here in that the federal government is now the loan giver in the case of students, not just in these schools, but in the case of all schools. And there is an issue here. That is the government who, and we are the government in the end, we the people, we put money out on the stump for students to come and get relatively easily. They do, I think, what's natural. If somebody leaves money out on the stump for me, I'm going to take it when I'm 18 years old. And then 4 or 5 years later, after I've tried to pursue my dreams, I discover that what I've really got is a nightmare because I have all this debt. So there is a responsibility issue here on the part of the government as well as the students. The government and the schools, all of them, whether it's Harvard or Georgetown or for-profit school, need to talk to young people about how much debt they accrue. We're all responsible. They are young people for the most part and can't be expected to be experts in finance.
Anthony Carnevale, director of the Center on Education and the Workforce at Georgetown University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, did you or do you go to a for-profit college? And do you think it helped you or harmed you in the long run? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can join our conversation on Facebook. KCRW Press Play. Okay, this is Your Brain on Drugs. Okay, maybe not your brain, but for young recreational pot users, I'm talking about people between 16 and 25 or so who smoke once or twice a week. Early studies are starting to show changes in the brain. And at the same time, scientists are focused on conducting new research since pot has changed so much since the 1990s. Back then, there might be 3 or 4% THC in marijuana. That's the chemical that gets you high. But with so many more varieties and legal and medicinal growing operations cropping up around the country, the THC has jumped to 30% or more in some strains of pot. And college-age students are consuming it in a variety of ways. Edibles, vaporizers, butane pens, and the more intense hash oil known as dabs. Abigail Sullivan Moore has been looking into the newer research for The New York Times, and she's here now. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. You talked to dispensary owners in Colorado. How different is the pot that's sold today from the pot that was researched and tested maybe 2 decades ago?
Well, I think that the THC content is much higher in what is being sold today, and it varies according to strain and form. So, you know, you'll have something like a hash oil concentrate, which is known as a dab, and which is vaped, or it's placed on a little dab of this very hard substance is placed on a hot surface, and sometimes they'll use like a little dome, and they inhale that. And that can have as much as 80% THC content as opposed to 2 or 3% THC content, which we saw back in the 80s. So, and I think even in the early 90s was 3%. So huge leap in THC content, and that is in the concentrates. And if you go into some of the other, if you go into, they make cartridges for vape pens, they can vary between 18 or 12% and 30% THC content. So you're seeing a great difference in the level of THC, which is the psychoactive component of the marijuana plant.
And how much research has been done on this new, more potent form of marijuana?
Well, I would say very little. From what I have seen, and of course I'm sure there are some studies underway that I don't know about, but the point that neuroscientists are making today is that some of the bedrock studies that were done on marijuana in the past, you know, two decades were done on strains of pot that had a much lower THC content. And so there is a concern that those studies are no longer relevant and that we really don't know what this more highly potent form of the plant is doing to people.
Now, you looked at one study that has come out recently. This is a study out of Harvard and Northwestern, and it looked at brains and what they look like, brains that of people who smoke pot and those who don't. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, what they did is they looked at a group of non-smokers, and then they looked at a group of smokers. And these are people who are ages 18 to 25, some of whom had smoked as little as, I believe, for 1 year or as much as for 6 years, and that was in the smoker group. And so what they did is they scanned the brains of these young adults, and they made a composite scan of the non-smoker brain and a composite scan of the smoker's brains. And then they looked at those two, and it's called a subtraction study. But what they found, essentially, was that there were structural differences overall in the smokers group, if you will. And they were concerned because the changes were seen in two key areas of the brain, and the nucleus accumbens and the amygdala. But the point is these are two very important parts of the brain, and they saw structural changes. Did they prove that they were caused by the marijuana? No. It wasn't that kind of study. It was an association. So what they found, though, was that there were no changes in the brains of non-smokers, but there were changes in the brains of the smokers, and the changes correlated with how much these young adults smoked. So the more they smoked, the bigger the change.
And are these permanent changes?
We don't know that.
And what kinds of functions does that do those parts of the brain control, and what kinds of behavioral changes would you expect?
Well, I think probably, you know, the most significant would have to do with the nucleus accumbens, and that is a part of the brain which helps us assess what's going on around us in our environment. It has to do with how we our emotional response to what's happening around us. It's also helps us form memories. One researcher described it to me as, he said it's the core. It has to do with motivation. It has to do with pleasure and pain, and basically every decision that you make. And this was the nucleus accumbens. It's really known as kind of the pleasure center of the brain. And so it's very, very significant that they saw changes in this key area.
So this is the place where, if it's developed, you can delay your gratification.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And if it's undeveloped, you have less ability to do that. You have less impulse control, in other words.
Well, if it's at the core of motivation, sure. I would say that's a fair assessment, because it's motivating you to go towards something, motivating you to draw away from something. So certainly impulsivity would be part of that. That is perhaps a function that would be affected by a change in
right.
this area.
Now this was on the young brain, brains of between 18 and
25.
Did you say 25-year-old? What about for older smokers? Any changes in the brains there?
They didn't look at older smokers. This group, the 18 to 25 group, is a group that really hasn't been studied very much, to my understanding. So that's why this was such a significant, study. It was small. And there are other studies underway to replicate it, but that's why it was such a significant study.
Now, there have been some studies related to mental illness and smoking mm-hmm. pot. And what can you tell us about that?
Well, these are studies, once again, that show associations. So we know that, especially if kids start to smoke young, there is an association with anxiety, depression. There's also an association if you have a genetic vulnerability for schizophrenia, you have an increased risk of developing schizophrenia. We know just in looking at there's a system that looks at emergency room admissions around the country, and we have seen a dramatic increase in the number of people coming in with marijuana-related issues. And one of the issues they're coming in with is psychosis. They're coming in with psychosis, and that in some people can be temporary. And once again, in somebody with schizophrenia, that's a permanent psychosis.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on today and talking to us about this.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Abigail Sullivan Moore, she wrote about recent pot research and the brain in the New York Times. Coming up on the program, how two guys were able to exploit a bug in a video poker game to make tons of money in Vegas before they were caught. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Slot machines used to live on the margins of the gambling industry. One-armed bandits sitting in the corners of casinos, played mainly by old ladies. Well, not anymore. These days, the slots have been modernized by video game technology, and they bring in as much as 85% of gambling profits. In Vegas, the machines are everywhere. They're in the airport, at bars, restaurants, gas stations, even 7-Eleven. And of course, no one really wins against the slots. Well, you might get an occasional jackpot, but in the long run, we know the fix is in. That is, until two guys happened upon the holy grail of slot machine addicts, a bug in the most popular video poker machine in the country. They raked in hundreds of thousands of dollars before getting caught. Kevin Paulson is contributing editor at Wired Magazine, and he wrote about this scheme. Welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Well, first off, describe the two men in your story.
So they're very different men in most respects. One of them, John Kane, lives in Las Vegas. He's an accomplished concert pianist and a successful businessman. The other, Andre Nestor, lived in Vegas for a while, and they were friends there. But Nestor is always flirting with bankruptcy. He never has a lot of money. They became close friends anyway because they have this shared love of gambling. So they became gambling buddies, and they would go out to the casinos several times a week together, and they became very tight.
And then how did they discover that there was a bug in this video poker game?
So John Kane was playing video poker. It's his favorite game. It's pretty much the only thing that he plays unless he's trying to be social. And he stumbled on the scenario where he was awarded a jackpot that he hadn't earned. And he at first he tried to bring it to the casino's attention, and they didn't believe him. They thought that he was just joking around. He contacted his friend Andre Nestor, and they poked at this together, and they eventually found a way to reproduce it. And it was a bug where, under exactly the right circumstances, if you do the right thing, you could get the machine to reward you an earlier win. So if you got a royal flush, you could go back and claim that royal flush again, except now you could do it at a much higher denomination. So you would play for a while at a maybe a quarter a credit, and then get a royal flush, and then return to it a little bit later, but now you would do it at $1 or $5 a credit, dramatically magnifying the win as well as claiming it for a second time.
And then they found that the key to this was the so-called double-up feature?
Yes. The double-up feature is an option in these machines. The casinos have to turn it on for you in most cases. They don't do it by default. So what Kane and Nestor wound up doing is they would just flag down a slot attendant and say, hey, I love the double-up feature. Would you turn it on for me? And slot attendants are kind of trained to indulge whatever superstitions or favorite modes of play that the players have. And so they would just open up the machine, and they would turn on this feature, and then Kane and Nestor would go to town playing it.
So what would they do, just go from casino to casino playing on these games? And
that's exactly what they did. Yeah, they wound up going to pretty much every major casino in Las Vegas. But by this time, Nestor had moved to the Pittsburgh area. He started going to a casino in that area and working the bug there. And they made, between them, about $1 million doing this over the span of just a few months.
Wow. But I imagine the casinos caught on to it. I mean, they must have seen that something was amiss pretty early on.
Yeah, so these guys made kind of a tactical error in that they weren't subtle in how they exploited the bug. They would, in some cases, they would stay on the same machine, claiming jackpot after jackpot, five times in the span of 2 hours. So eventually, one of the casinos caught on. It was the Silverton in Las Vegas. They were watching through the surveillance cameras. They figured out there was something really suspicious about what Kane was doing. They called in the gaming control board, who arrested Kane. They took the machine, they confiscated its motherboard, took it back to the laboratory, and they eventually reverse-engineered the bug and figured out exactly what was going on.
So he's arrested, and then also a little bit after that, Nestor's also arrested.
Yeah, Nestor, even after Kane's arrest, Nestor kept playing, but then he was arrested under very much the same circumstances in Pennsylvania. Nestor was initially charged with theft, with over 100 counts of theft and other crimes in Pennsylvania. Then the FBI took over the case in 2012, and they charged both Kane and Nestor with computer hacking, basically arguing that by using this bug as they did, they were exceeding their authorized access to the machine. So legally, it was no different than if they'd hacked into it from the outside.
So they were charged under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
That's correct.
And just incidentally, you point out in your story that was the same charge that Aaron Swartz, the internet activist, was charged with when he downloaded all those academic articles, and then he later committed suicide.
Yes. The law is has been applied in some pretty odd ways, and it's one where the government is constantly experimenting with just how they could apply it and in what circumstances. So that was the case here. There'd never been a case of the CFAA being used to prosecute somebody for cheating at a casino game. And in the end, that wound up being a poor use of the law, and a judge in the case saw that and telegraphed that the case was going to be thrown out, and the government wound up dismissing the charges voluntarily, and Kane and Nestor were set free.
Oh, so they got away with it.
Yeah, in some ways they did. I mean, this was a couple of years of legal fighting. Kane had a private attorney, which I imagine cost him a lot of money. Nestor's money was all seized by the state in his Pennsylvania case, and he never got it back. So he's working now with a lawyer to try and find a way to get the money back. So it wasn't a case of all's well, it ends well. They did not wind up terribly enriched by the whole thing. But at the same time, neither of them is in jail.
Well, I guess the question is, did they do anything illegal? They won at this game, and they didn't hack it. They didn't try to change the way the game was originally designed. They just found a weakness and exploited it.
And that's one of the things that really drew me to this story. When you sit down at one of these machines, it's an adversarial situation by definition. You're supposed to sit down and do anything that the machine allows you to do and to try and beat the machine under those rules that the machine itself imposes. So that's kind of the situation going in. So these guys, they found a way to beat the machine at its own game. But is that really a crime? And in this case, it definitely wasn't computer hacking, and the feds didn't have any other charge for it that seemed to fit.
So where are they now, John Cain and Andre Nestor?
Nestor is still in the Pittsburgh area. Cain is still in Vegas, and really nothing has changed. I believe that they're both gambling still. I guess I don't know that of Cain, but I have no reason to doubt it. Nestor is banned from every casino in Pennsylvania, so he gambles infrequently. He has to drive to another state to do it.
I guess you just can't shake it once you get the bug.
Yeah.
Kevin Paulson, contributing editor at Wired Magazine and author of Kingpin, How One Hacker Took Over the $1 Billion Cybercrime Underground. Kevin, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the world of the television showrunner. A new documentary takes a peek behind the curtain to find out what it's really like to make a successful TV show. That's after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. These days, some of the biggest names in TV aren't the actors or actresses on the screen, but the men and women behind the camera. Shonda Rhimes, Matt Weiner, J.J. Abrams, Joss Whedon, just to name a few. It would seem that the golden age of TV has given rise to the celebrity showrunner, a catch-all term for the person in charge of a TV show, from writing and producing to budgeting and negotiating with network executives, and it's not easy.
The burnout rate for showrunners is 100%. If you said to them, the only way that I'm going to be able to produce the next episode is on a hospital gurney with an IV running into my line, they would say, great, what kind of gurney do you like? Because here are three choices. And what would you like in the IV?
That's Bill Prady, showrunner for Big Bang Theory. He's one of the people featured in a new documentary called Showrunners, The Art of Running a TV Show. The film is directed by Des Doyle, who joins me now. Hi, Des.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. And also in the studio with me, Hart Hansen. He is the creator, the showrunner of Bones.
Hello.
Congratulations in your 10th season.
Thank you very much.
Now, there's some confusion out there, maybe everywhere, about what exactly a showrunner does. And in fact, in the movie, your dad seems a little confused about what you do.
Yeah. My dad came as I was watching Emily go through Emily Deschanel, who plays Dr. Temperance Brennan on Bones, go through one of her tougher scientific analyses. And he turns to me and says, wow, how does she come up with that stuff? And this is my own father.
And you had written this.
Yes, I'd written it, yeah. And he was also astounded to find out, well, he knows me. He was astounded to find out that I was the boss of Bones. I think he assumed that I had written a nice little script and then I visited or something. He just had a different way of looking at it.
So how do you explain to people who aren't here in Hollywood, in L.A., what you do?
Well, I mean, the fast version is that you are the, the final arbiter on a show, in casting, scripts, post, music, all of that. That's one way of saying it. The other way of saying it that is just as accurate is that you get credit for the work of about 200 people who are shoving you in a particular direction. You vacillate between those two. Sometimes you're the boss and sometimes you're not the boss.
Let's listen to how Jeff Melvoin from the show Army Wives puts it.
The skill sets to be a good writer and to be a good manager are almost diametrically opposite. I think writers tend to be skeptics, critics. They're fueled by anger, by curiosity, by outrage. Whereas when you're managing, you have so many different aspects of production to be concerned about. The writers are your most immediate, but then you've got to deal with actors, and you've got to deal with your directors, and you've got to deal with everybody else. Those skills are not innate.
So, Des, why is it set up like this? Why is one person responsible for all these different things and different skill sets?
I think it kind of evolved into that over time. If you go back to the 60s and 70s, I think there was a more kind of producer and maybe head writer kind of role in those days. But I think because the shows have evolved into something much more complicated to produce, something much more cinematic, I think audiences are expecting a great deal more from television drama these days. So the writer's role has become kind of more and more important over time in relation to that, because the show is their baby.
I remember a time, especially when I was working in Canada, where I would be the head writer on a show, but that someone else, the executive producer, would be the person who called the shots. And I have found that as I became the one to call the shots, to be in charge, that maybe the script didn't quite get the blame it deserved when something was going wrong. So, you know, an episode turns out to be not very good. Very seldom will the writing showrunner say, that script was at fault. Let's blame that director. So it makes me,
Which do you prefer? Do you prefer the writing part or the managing people part?
I infinitely prefer the writing part. If there was a job where a guy my age could sit in a back room and just write scripts for something, I would do that. But because I'm in my 50s, I'm expected to be a showrunner, to be an executive producer.
I think actually every single showrunner we interviewed said the same thing. They would all prefer to be writers. If they could just do that and not have to deal with everything else, that would be ideal for them.
But would they make the same amount of money?
No.
So would you take a pay cut just to be a writer?
Yes. You're looking at me in disbelief. Yes, I would take. I would do this if I got a living wage, especially if I just got to write.
Your bosses are now listening to this.
I am.
The network is now taking
I reach. Think they know my attitude.
Well, now that we've raised this issue, your relationship with the network, oftentimes there is a tense relationship between showrunners and the networks. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. You know, everybody has their own agenda. You know, in a network TV show, there's the network, there's the studio that underwrites the show that pays for it, and then there's the creative team headed by the showrunner that makes the show. And they all have slightly different agendas. So somehow you have to pay attention to the good advice and yet hold the center. Because if you take everyone's advice, if you listen to all the notes that everyone gives you, you end up with pudding and not delicious pudding, a dog's breakfast kind of pudding instead. So yeah, it's always very, there's lots, there's yelling and then making up and then more yelling and then more making up.
How do you make up?
My favorite way to make up is I get to go have drinks with Dana Walden, who runs 20th Century Fox, and we're just nice to each other. Because generally I'm not mean to her, I'm mean to her subordinates. And we come to some agreement, and that's my favorite way. That's rather pleasant.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Hart Hansen. He's the showrunner of Bones, and Des Doyle, the director of the new documentary. It's called Showrunners, The Art of Running a TV Show. And Des, you got a lot of funding from, I think it's the Irish Film Board.
Yeah.
And how did you convince them that they should fund a movie about American showrunners?
Yeah, I get asked this question a lot. I completely looked out. The particular executive that I pitched to at the Film Board, who's a lovely man called Alan Marr, happens to be a huge fan of American TV himself and had an interest in showrunners and what showrunners do. And when I originally came over, because I was first time, like no one had ever heard of me. I had no track record here. So I think it took us about 4 months to actually get the first person on camera.
And who was that?
The very first person we got on camera was actually Mark Schwann from One Tree Hill, who very unfortunately is not in the finished film for a number of different reasons. But the main kind of interview that really changed everything for us is when Damon Lindelof agreed to take part, and he gave us a fantastic interview. He was incredibly candid with us, as everybody has been. I'm still.
What was the most surprising thing he told you? He's the creator of Lost.
The most surprising thing he told me. If he could go back in time and if he was asked the same question, would he do Lost again? The answer would be no.
My friend Heather was an executive at ABC, and she called me on a Friday night, and she said, do you want to meet with JJ on Monday? And I said yes. And in saying yes to that question, I basically completely changed my destiny. And if I had said yes, and then Heather had said to me, listen, this is going to be the next 6 years of your life. It is going to define you. The word next to your name when you die is going to be lost. No matter what you do, it's going to say lost writer. You know, how do you feel about that? I would have said, forget it. I'm not taking the meeting.
That's quite an admission for someone who's still relatively young and you know, has a long career in front of them, to kind of feel that they're tied in some way in that regard. So I thought that was quite an honest comment.
But that's true with a lot of people. Jerry Seinfeld, for example. I guess his name is Seinfeld. So.
Yeah.
Is it?
But I don't know if it's slightly different for actors who are kind of out the front compared to maybe writers who might slightly be more in the background, although obviously that is changing. I don't know if they quite expected the level of association. And I mean, Damon and Carlton were as well known as any of the actors on that show, like, you know.
And they got yelled at.
They got yelled at.
Damon, I think, actually
because
left
of the
social because of the ending.
Yeah.
People had very, very strong opinions on the ending.
Yeah, I mean, that really split the fan base for that show. And I mean, the level of vitriol directed at him on Twitter is very unfortunate. I mean, for someone who's writing a piece of something that's trying to entertain people, it's like he committed war crimes or something, you know. And people can get very, very passionate and very, very, it's very easy to push the hate button on Twitter very quickly, like, you know. So one of the things I hope when people watch the film is they might give showrunners a slightly easier time from now on when they realize, one, how difficult it is to do the job, and two, that not everything is their fault.
So when you came to the end of making this film and interviewing all these showrunners, how much of the end result is their vision, is their stamp, their show?
100%. I think that's the whole purpose, if you like, of a showrunner, is someone goes into a room and has to fight daily, either the studio, the network, or the writers, or their actors, or whatever it is, for the show that they want to make. You know, I remember Jane Espenson saying to me that you can't be not afraid to go into a room and piss people off. It's not a people-pleasing exercise. If you're trying to get done what you want to get do and make the show that you want to make, sometimes there's a lot of fighting and stress and stuff that comes with that.
One of the signs that you're headed in the right direction is that everybody you meet during the day is just slightly annoyed with you, just a little bit irked with you.
And that's then, a sign of success?
Yeah, you're probably threading the needle pretty well, as opposed to on a day when five people hate your guts and three love you. You're probably not threading the needle as successfully.
And it's been said, Shonda Rhimes notwithstanding, that this is a white man's game.
Yeah.
A white man.
There certainly is an issue to an extent within the industry in terms of both female showrunners and showrunners from different ethnicities not possibly being as represented as well as they should have. We did actually try very, very hard to get Shonda for the film, but for whatever reason, she decided not to do it. But
she's running 500 shows.
Yeah.
It's a little busy.
She's pretty, I mean, I think they're calling Thursday night Shonda night these days.
Yeah.
I mean, the women that we do have in the film, like, they would say that the situation is changing, but slowly. You know, I think certainly Shonda's success, you know, proves or disproves possibly a myth that a woman can't. I remember Dee Johnson, who's one of the showrunners on Nashville, saying to me that she found sometimes in writers' rooms that there's something in the tenor of a woman's voice that men find very easy to ignore. So sometimes she would find herself having to go to, like, nuclear bitch level, as she described it, to actually, you know, make her point and get her point across. And that's not where she wants to be or where anybody wants to be, you know. So I do hope that is something that does continue to change, you know.
Hart, you are very healthy and energetic, but you do mention that sometimes you walk by a room and you see a bunch of young guys in there and you think, nipping at my heels. This is a young man's game.
It is a young man's game. I think it's a young person's game. Keeping up the levels of energy is really essential. And one of the other things a showrunner has to be, I think it was Tom Fontana, who I read in a book he wrote about showrunning way back. He's the one who said that it's a showrunner's job that no matter how bad things are going, to show and declaim otherwise. Like, you're supposed to say, it's going great, it's going wonderful. You have to push a ton of energy into the show. And that's why I think it's better for people who aren't at my advanced years, wow, in my 50s.
But yet you're launching a new show.
So. I know. If I ever go to therapy, I will ask why I did that, because it's fun and awful and fun, as Bill Prady says.
I mean, when I started out, I thought I had a level of respect for showrunners, but it's like quantum level at this point in time. I mean, even for shows that I may not personally enjoy or want to watch, I'd totally take my hat off to the person who's running that show, because they're working as hard as they possibly can to make a piece of entertainment that they think is going to work for whatever audience they're trying. It's an incredibly difficult job. And if you're producing 22 to 24 on broadcast, you're probably doing a minimum of a 12-hour day, 12 to 14-hour day every day. You're going to be working a ton of weekends. I think Andrew Marlowe, the last time I spoke to him from Castle, he said to me, I think he had 7 days off last year. So it's a monumental workload. It really is. I don't know if people fully appreciate the amount of work that does go into producing that number of episodes.
Gosh, and we just sit down for an hour and go, let's see what's on TV.
Yeah, I don't like that.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for coming in. I know, Hart, you're very busy, for one.
No, I'm close, though. I'm at the Fox lot. It's just down the street.
Okay. Well, thanks you guys very much for coming in.
Thank you.
That's Hart Hansen. He is the EP of Bones. And Des Doyle, he's the director of Showrunners, The Art of Running a TV Show. It is at the Arena Theater beginning tomorrow and at iTunes Video On Demand. Well, you're kind of the showrunner for To The Point.
Well, I'm not a showrunner. We have producers. I would give them the credit for being the show.
Well, that's awfully
runners,
nice
people
of you
that,
to say.
That do all the work. We're going to be talking today on our program about solar power, which is going to be cheaper than anything else very soon in the United States, maybe as soon as 2015 or 16.
Really?
Excuse me, 16 or 17.
I got that wrong. 2 years?
Yeah, but that doesn't mean there's going to be an easy transition. And but it does appear that
is the problem. Pardon? How do you store it?
Well, that's one of the issues, and battery technology is getting cheaper and cheaper. Uh-huh. That's a very good question. Anyway, it's a really interesting subject, and much more so than I anticipated going in. It's quite riveting. We're also going to have another interesting conversation about the fact that 2 billion people in the world eat insects. And now they're making their way into the Western diet. You know, there are restaurants here in L.A., San Francisco.
Have you ever eaten an insect?
I had a cookie today that was made with ground up crickets.
And?
Very tasty.
You got your protein allotment for the day.
You got it. That's
all right. Warren Olney and To The Point coming up at 1 o'clock. And on this program coming up, admit it, you've always wanted your own Mr. Bates. Well, now, thanks to a new San Francisco startup, you can. The Uber of manservants. Next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
In the beginning, there were strippers. Man's idea of a pleasurable pastime. Then came the women's rights movement. Equality allowed women to have her stripper and her penis cake too. But ladies, whose idea of sexy is this?
That's an ad from the new service Manservant, which rents out men by the hour to do things like feed you grapes, hold your umbrella, or massage your shoulders. Or, as our next guest calls it, Uber for good-looking men you can order around. Julianne Smolinski is a writer and actor and recently spent some time with a couple of manservants. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I'm great. My first question is this for real?
It is for real. I mean, it kind of is. It's only available in San Francisco now, and it it doesn't really feel real.
Who came up with it?
It's these two women who used to work in advertising, and it really kind of sounds like kind of startup idea you come up with when you've had a few.
So just perfect for San Francisco these days.
Mm-hmm.
And so you decided to try it out. And did you originally think that this is kind of a dressed up escort service?
That's really what it sounds like. I think it kind of is. It's kind of this uncanny valley between a stripper and a butler. And the website and the women really kind of emphasize that it's not sexual, but there's really kind of, I don't know how you make it not a sexual thing when there's a guy like massaging you and doing whatever you tell him to all day.
Well, are they allowed to do whatever you want?
They can't do anything sexy, obviously. They're not supposed to drink anything, which is, you know, probably for the best. I think just because it's still kind of in its infancy, the lines feel a little blurry.
Okay, so when you ordered up your manservant, could you say, all right, I want this type of guy, I want him to do X, Y, Z, I want him to look like that? Or
yeah,
what?
There's an order form, which is really unsettling. I don't know if you've ever ordered up a human being before.
But never.
You get to pick between like a jacked body type or a hipster body type and blonde or brunette, so it feels a little tiny bit sleazy.
Okay, so who did you get? What did you order?
I got two different guys, and the one was kind of just like a generic, good-looking blonde dude, but I specified that he should act like Teddy Roosevelt the entire time, which didn't go well, so that was weird.
And then, did he carry a large stick?
He did not. He did not have a large stick. They have like a little bag with a fan and Purell and flowers and an umbrella. It's very strange.
And where did you have him do?
He took my friend and I around San Francisco to some kind of touristy bars and really tried admirably to keep up the whole historical role play part. But then he admitted to me that he had only watched about an hour of the Ken Burns Theodore Roosevelt documentary, and that was where his knowledge ended. So.
So he kind of dropped the pretense.
Yeah, he had to. He ran out of history at some point.
And so then was it a little awkward to have him kind of as a, I don't know, like a fifth wheel or something?
Yeah, it was incredibly awkward. It was very strange because, you know, I didn't really have anything for him to do. It wasn't like, you know, some of these guys are kind of for bachelorette parties or you use them as a personal assistant. And, you know, I was visiting town for the express purpose of ordering this guy up, and I had nothing to do with him. So it ended up being like a bad date that I was paying for.
How much were you paying?
This service is $125 an hour.
Oh, so it's not cheap
no,
to have a manservant.
Yeah.
Well, could he actually be your servant, like do things you don't want to do, the laundry or go grocery shopping?
Oh, yeah, they totally do things like that. Those are some of the options that they list and just kind of, I think that you could probably do kind of the personal assistant part of it if you wanted to, but I don't really know why you would for that price.
Yeah, right, because I guess having a personal assistant or having any kind of assistant might be a little less expensive.
Yeah, well, but he might not be as handsome.
So you're paying for the looks.
Yeah, pretty much.
Did you get a chance to interview your manservant about what he thinks of it?
You know, I did a little bit, except that he was really kind of cautious about his job. I think that we went off the record a little bit. You know, I think that he kind of wanted to say more than he did. But he seemed like he's having fun. I didn't feel bad for him at all. I felt worse for myself.
So he was no Mr. Bates?
No, he was not. He was not Mr. Bates at all. Although he was cuter than Mr. Bates.
No Thomas, then.
Yeah, no Thomas.
Well, speaking of, this seems like it might be a service targeting gay men. Like, gay men might be interested in this.
Yeah, and that was kind of the other thing. I'm not sure if men can use manservants right now, but I don't know how you, they imply that they're gay friendly, but I don't know how you make somebody prove that they're gay before they order a guy. So.
Right. That would be a little untoward. Do you think that this is going to take off?
No, I don't. I don't really think that there's a market for it.
So even in San Francisco, where there are tons of wacky ideas, wacky entrepreneurial tech ideas, you don't see this as becoming a thing?
I don't necessarily. I just don't think the demand for it is there. I think that women who are having bachelorette parties and want kind of the stripper experience are going to want an actual stripper. I mean, I think it's kind of sad if the whole point of it is to pay a hot guy to be nice to you.
Julianne Smolinski. Her article on manservants is at matter.com. Hello, Jolie Myers.
Hi. You know, I've actually hired a manservant to do feedback today. So without further ado, Warren Olney, everybody. No, he's gone. He's hearing his show in like 4 minutes. So we talked about the life of showrunners today, and we talked about how showrunners are increasingly in the figurative crosshairs of TV fans.
Yeah.
We asked you if you've ever been infuriated by a show that you love. Anthony Williams wrote on our Facebook page, he's a big TV fan, and he generally gives showrunners the benefit of the doubt. He says he's gotten on board with weird time travel storylines a la Felicity. He says he survived ghost sex on Grey's Anatomy, and he's even still watching Glee. But Moesha. Oh, Moesha. That was the 90s sitcom. It starred Brandy. She's a pop star. Apparently, they canceled the show and never resolved some pretty major storylines. Apparently, Moesha's little brother had been kidnapped, and then she might have maybe been pregnant, and they totally pulled the plug on the show. And Anthony Williams says, no, that is the one thing I could not get on board with. Figure out a way to resolve that
stuff.
Still
dealing with that.
Still dealing with the fallout from Moesha.
That's amazing.
In 1999
or whatever.
20
years later.
Right?
Okay.
I mean, that really made an impression on him. I can't say that I've ever watched an episode of Moesha, but I kind of feel his pain, although I'm not a masochist, so I didn't watch Lost, so I can't really get on board with that whole thing. We also talked about gainful employment and for-profit colleges. We heard from Aaron. He's a chef, and he says that some of the worst offenders out there right now are for-profit cooking schools. He says kids pay a lot of money to get culinary degrees at these places, but when they get out of the school and start working in kitchens, they can barely hold a knife. Aaron says he feels really bad. He wants to give these kids a chance in his kitchen, but many of them just aren't ready for prime time.
Wow, that's fascinating. Thank you very much, Jolie Myers.
Of course.
And keep the feedback coming. Our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Let me say that again, KCRW Press Play. Twitter, at KCRW Press Play. Voicemail, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. There's a theme here, I think. Anyway, Warren Olney, and To The Point, up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.